Imagine your mind is like a solid frozen block of ice.
Okay.
Every deep-seated habit, every lingering anxiety, every rigid assumption you hold about yourself and the world, it's all just trapped inside that block.
Right, locked in completely.
Yeah. Now, what if taking a psychedelic isn't just about experiencing some wild hallucination?
Yeah.
What if, mechanically speaking, it is simply the act of turning up the heat and watching that rigid ice just melt into fluid water?
It's a powerful visual.
It really is. And today, we are exploring a concept that fundamentally changes how we view the human mind. Because for years, when we've talked about the brain, there has always been this, this comforting expectation of geography.
Yes, the mapping approach.
Exactly. It's like reading a map. You point to a brightly colored blob on an fMRI scan and you say, you know, right there, that little cluster, that's where your math skills live.
Which is neat.
It's very neat. It's categorized. It feels incredibly engineered and safe.
But it gives us a completely false sense of mastery. Well, we think if we can just map all the little discrete regions, you know, the amygdala for fear, the hippocampus for memory, the prefrontal cortex for executive function, we feel like we understand the whole machine.
Right, like we solved the puzzle.
But that geographical approach falls completely apart when you try to understand something as terrifyingly complex as human consciousness. We've essentially treated the brain like a collection of isolated islands.
Instead of a single dynamic ocean.
Exactly.
And nowhere does that island model fail harder than in the world of psychedelics.
Mm.
I mean, think about it. If you look at the scientific literature on things like psilocybin or LSD over the last few decades, it's just a mess of scattered, almost contradictory explanations.
You're really a has-been.
You have one camp of researchers talking about the quieting of the ego.
Right.
And then another camp is laser-focused on neurogenesis, like the actual rewiring of neural pathways.
Yeah, the biological side.
And then you have psychiatrists pointing to this mystical afterglow period where depression just seems to magically lift. You end up holding all these disparate puzzle pieces, just wondering how they could possibly belong to the same puzzle.
Because neuroscience was just holding those pieces and treating them as separate events.
Like they were connected.
Yeah, they were treating ego dissolution as one distinct phenomenon, the disruption of brain networks as a completely separate biological event, and the therapeutic benefits as yet another entirely different thing.
So it was just a list of symptoms.
Precisely. It was a list of symptoms, and what was desperately missing was a diagnosis of the underlying mechanism. We needed a foundational law that could explain why a chemical interacting with a serotonin receptor could simultaneously make the walls look like they're breathing,
right,
dissolve your sense of being a distinct individual, and somehow cure treatment-resistant depression.
Which is a huge claim. And that brings us to the mission for today's deep dive. What if you didn't need 100 different specialized theories? What if there is one single, elegant, overarching idea sitting underneath all of it?
And that's what we're looking at today.
Exactly. Today, we are diving into a truly fascinating paper from the OOTW Journal titled The Entropic Brain, The Theory That Explains Psychedelics. This framework was proposed by a neuroscientist named Robin Carhart-Harris back in 2014, and it has caused, honestly, a massive earthquake in the field.
A total paradigm shift.
Yeah. Our goal today is to help you, the listener, understand what is widely considered the closest thing psychedelic neuroscience has to a grand unified theory.
Because we aren't just talking about what molecules do to receptors here.
Right.
The entropic brain theory is fundamentally redefining what consciousness actually is. It moves us completely away from that geography of the brain we just talked about.
So no more islands.
No more islands. Instead, we are looking at the richness of your conscious experience as this continuous, delicate dance between order and disorder.
Okay, so to understand how a psychedelic alters consciousness, we first have to understand the specific metric this theory uses to measure it. And that brings us to a word that, honestly, probably triggers a bit of high school physics class dread for you listening right now.
I definitely.
Entropy.
It carries an enormous amount of baggage, that word.
It really does.
Most people hear entropy and their minds immediately jump to the second law of thermodynamic.
Right, like the inevitable heat death of the universe.
Exactly. Or the fact that a dropped coffee mug shatters and can never spontaneously reassemble itself. They just think of pure, unavoidable decay.
Right, just everything falling apart and getting messy.
But Carhart-Harris isn't using the thermodynamic definition of entropy here.
He's not.
No, he's leaning heavily into information theory.
Okay.
In this context, which was developed originally by mathematicians like Claude Shannon, entropy simply means unpredictability.
Unpredictability.
Yes. It's a measure of how many different possible ways a system could be arranged at any given moment.
So it's not about decay at all. It's about variance.
Precisely. Let's look at it as a spectrum of predictability.
Okay.
A highly ordered, tidy, rigid system is a low entropy system. Okay. Because it is highly organized, it is almost entirely predictable. It has very few possible states it can exist in.
Give me an example of that.
Think of a metronome ticking at a constant speed. That is incredibly low entropy. You know exactly where the pendulum will be 3 seconds from now.
Right. It's totally fixed.
But on the other end of the spectrum, a loose, flexible, chaotic system is a high entropy system. It has an enormous number of possible states, making it incredibly hard to predict what it will do next.
So like TV static.
Perfect example. TV yeah. static is high entropy. You have no idea what pixel is going to flash next.
Okay, let me see if I can ground this in a mental analogy for you guys listening. Say, my mind is a highly organized filing cabinet.
Okay, I like this.
Every single thought, memory, and impulse has a strict color-coded folder. That is a low entropy state.
Right.
It's efficient. Like, if I need a memory of my 10th birthday, my brain goes to the childhood drawer, opens the birthdays folder, and boom, there it is.
Very predictable.
Exactly. Hmm. But the catch is, nothing surprising ever happens in that filing cabinet.
It's rigid. A tax document is never going to accidentally end up in the childhood birthdays folder.
Right, that would never happen. But if I were to pull all those drawers out and just dump thousands of files onto the living room floor, suddenly a sterile W-2 tax form is sitting right next to a deeply emotional Polaroid from 1995.
Which creates a completely novel connection.
A wildly new, unpredictable connection that would never ever have happened in the structured system. So that dumped pile of files on the floor, that is high entropy.
That captures the transition perfectly, and this is the bold leap that Carhart-Harris made.
Okay.
The core claim of the entropic brain hypothesis is that the entropy of your brain's spontaneous electrical activity is a direct index of the richness of your conscious experience.
Okay, wait, I have to stop you there. How do you actually measure the entropy of a brain?
That is the big question.
Because you can't just open up the skull and look for dumped files.
Here.
The paper mentions brain scans, but what is a scanner actually calculating when it claims a brain is unpredictable?
It's a crucial question because without the math, this entire theory is just poetry.
Right.
So neuroscientists use tools like fMRI, which measures blood flow changes in the brain, or magnetoencephalography.
Magneto what?
Magnetoencephalography. It measures the actual magnetic fields generated by the electrical currents of your neurons in real time.
Wow.
And meg is incredibly fast. When they look at the data pouring out of these machines, they run algorithms on it to test its compressibility.
Compressibility, like zipping a file on a computer.
Literally just like that. Right. One of the main algorithms used is called Lempel-Ziv complexity.
Okay.
And it is fundamentally similar to how software compresses a massive file into a ZIP file. If you have a document that just says the word brain 10,000 times, a compression algorithm can shrink that file down almost nothing.
Because it just writes a rule, right? Like, print brain 10,000 times.
Exactly. It's highly repetitive, highly ordered, and therefore it's low entropy.
Makes sense.
But if you have a document filled with 10,000 completely random diverse characters, the algorithm can't compress it.
Because there are no patterns to take shortcuts with.
Right. It remains a large file. It is uncompressible, so it is high entropy.
Oh, wow. So when they scan a brain, they are literally looking at how repetitive or how chaotic the electrical signals are.
Yes. They look at the diversity of the neural signals. Less entropy, meaning a highly compressible, repetitive brain signal, equates to a narrower, more constrained, highly predictable experience of reality.
You were in the filing cabinet.
Yes. More entropy, an uncompressible, wildly diverse brain signal, equates to a wider, more expansive, highly unpredictable experience.
You are staring at the files on the floor.
Precisely.
That reframing is just wild to me. We are essentially mapping the subjective, deeply personal feeling of a rich mind to the cold, hard unpredictability of an electrical system.
It's bridging the gap between physics and psychology.
It really is.
Right.
Which begs an important question for you listening to this right now. If entropy is the dial of consciousness, where is your dial normally set?
A very good question.
Like on a regular Tuesday morning, as you are drinking your coffee, driving to work, checking your emails, Where are you on that spectrum between the rigid filing cabinet and the chaotic pile on the floor?
Well, the theory argues that on a normal Tuesday, your brain is neither maximally ordered nor maximally chaotic.
Okay.
It is not a perfectly rigid frozen crystal, but it is not a chaotic formless gas either. It sits in a highly specific, finely tuned zone that physicists refer to as being just below criticality.
Just below criticality. Or subcritical.
Yes, in a slightly subcritical state.
Criticality. That sounds like a nuclear reactor is about to melt down. What does the critical edge actually mean in this context?
It's a concept borrowed straight from statistical mechanics.
Okay, lay it on me.
Criticality is defined as the absolute knife edge transition zone between order and disorder.
The knife edge.
Yeah. It is the exact tipping point where a system is maximally poised, maximally sensitive, and completely free. The source material uses a few classic models to explain this.
Like what?
Think of a pot of water on the stove.
Okay, got it.
The instant before it boils, it is transitioning from a highly structured, dense liquid to a chaotic, high-entropy gas.
Right.
That specific temperature where pockets of liquid and pockets of gas are wildly fluctuating, that is a critical state.
Oh, I see.
Another famous model in physics is the sand pile. Imagine you are slowly dropping grains of sand onto a flat surface.
Like an hourglass?
Sure, we're just making a pile. It builds a little cone.
Mm.
As you keep dropping grains, the cone gets steeper and steeper until it reaches a very specific angle of repose.
Okay.
At that exact angle, the entire pile is perfectly poised so that dropping one single additional grain could do absolutely nothing or
it could cause the whole thing to collapse.
Exactly. It could cause a massive avalanche that cascades down the entire side. That precise state of maximum instability and maximum potential, that is criticality.
The water about to boil, the sand about to slip. So normal waking consciousness is hovering just below that boiling point.
We are subcritical.
We are close to the edge, but we are holding ourselves back. But wait. Here's where I get a little stuck.
What's that?
If criticality is this state of being maximally free, maximally sensitive, and possessing the highest possible richness of experience, why wouldn't the human brain just evolve to live right on that critical edge all the time?
It sounds ideal, right?
Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't want to be infinitely open and expansive on a Tuesday morning?
Well, because you wouldn't survive to see Wednesday.
Oh, right.
Evolution demands a brutal trade-off here. Being right on the critical edge gives you maximum flexibility and cognitive richness, but it completely sacrifices stability.
Meaning what, practically?
Meaning if you are entirely in a critical or high-entropy state, you lose the ability to consistently differentiate your own body from your environment. You lose the ability to accurately filter sensory information.
Like sensory overload.
Totally. A passing shadow might seem just as profound and demanding of your attention as an oncoming bus.
Oh, wow. I see. If a tiger is jumping out of the bushes, you do not want your brain exploring the infinite beauty and mathematical geometry of the tiger's orange and black stripes.
Definitely not.
You don't want to be making novel poetic connections about the nature of the jungle. You want a low entropy, highly predictable, utterly rigid program that immediately says, tiger, danger, run.
Exactly. The subcritical constraint is an absolute necessity for survival in a dangerous physical world. That constraint is the very thing that gives us a stable sense of self.
The ego.
Yes, the ego. It allows for reliable reality testing. It allows for logical deduction.
Right.
It enables metacognition, which is just the ability to recognize that you are thinking about a thought. It keeps us safely back from the avalanche.
So it's a protective mechanism.
Completely. It is what makes normal consciousness feel solid, bounded, and continuous from day to day. You wake up knowing your name, knowing what your job is, and understanding the physical laws of the room you were standing in.
It's the gravity that keeps us from floating away into the chaotic gas.
That's a great way to put it.
But this subcritical safety comes with a heavy tax, doesn't it?
It does.
By definition, keeping ourselves below the boiling point makes the everyday mind a little rigid. We are fundamentally constrained. We trade the awe-inspiring richness of all possible experiences for the mundane safety of a predictable experience.
We give up the magic for the sake of the mundane, because the mundane keeps you alive.
So that perfectly establishes our baseline. You and I, and everyone listening, are walking around day to day in a slightly subcritical state.
Right.
We rely on our neat mental filing cabinets.
Yeah.
We are safe, we are stable, but we are constrained. So, mechanically speaking, what happens inside the physical hardware of the brain when a person takes a psychedelic compound?
How does it actually push the dial?
Exactly. How does it push us toward that critical edge?
Well, according to the framework, psychedelics do one fundamental thing. They raise the entropy of the brain. They forcefully push the entire neural system up out of its comfortable, constrained, subcritical zone directly toward that chaotic, critical edge.
They turn the heat up under the water.
They do.
But how? What is the actual lever being pulled in the biology of the brain?
It starts at the molecular level, specifically with the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor.
5-HT2A.
Psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, and DMT are agonists for this specific receptor, meaning they bind to it and activate it. Now, these 5-HT2A receptors aren't just scattered randomly throughout your head.
Where are they?
They're heavily concentrated in the cortex, specifically on a type of cell called layer 5 pyramidal neurons.
Layer 5 pyramidal neurons. Why are those specific neurons important?
Because layer 5 pyramidal neurons are essentially the heavy communication cables of the brain.
Like the fiber optics.
Exactly. They span across different layers of the cortex and connect disparate regions. When a psychedelic binds to these receptors, it excites these deep neurons, causing them to fire in a highly asynchronous, disorganized way.
Disorganized?
Right. In our normal subcritical state, the brain relies on slow, rhythmic waves, like alpha waves, to keep different brain regions synchronized. It's like a conductor keeping an entire orchestra playing the exact same sheet music.
But the psychedelic fires up these layer 5 neurons, and the conductor just gets thrown off the podium.
Totally thrown off. The rhythmic organizing constraints break down. The alpha power drops significantly.
Wow.
And without that conductor keeping everything segregated and ordered, the entropy skyrockets. The system becomes highly complex and incredibly unpredictable.
And this is where the brain scans come in, right?
Yes, exactly.
When they put someone under the influence of psilocybin into an fMRI or a MEG scanner, the lentils of complexity, that mathematical ZIP file algorithm we talked about earlier, it goes off the charts.
It does.
The brain signal becomes vastly less compressible. It is demonstrably more chaotic.
And we see a literal breakdown of the brain's usual borders. In our normal subcritical state, the brain operates using highly segregated networks.
Like what?
Well, the visual network talks to the visual network, the motor network talks to the motor network, and they only communicate with each other through very strict, highly regulated channels.
Okay, keeping everything in its lane.
Right. And the king of all these segregated networks is the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN. We've brought up the DMN on this show before, but for a quick refresher for you guys listening, it's often described as the brain's CEO. Right? Or the neurological seat of the ego.
Yes, that's a very common way to describe it.
It's the network that lights up when you are daydreaming, thinking about the past, worrying about the future, or just obsessing over yourself in general.
The DMN is essentially the heavy constraint that maintains our subcritical state. It is the most energy-hungry, dominant network in the waking brain.
It enforces the order.
It absolutely does. But under a psychedelic, as entropy rises and those alpha rhythms collapse, the DMN loses its grip. The strict segregation fails completely. Networks that normally never, ever speak to one another suddenly begin to communicate directly.
The filing cabinet is overturned. All the folders are mixing.
And the brain becomes hyperconnected, but in a totally disorganized way. This global increase in functional connectivity across normally isolated networks is the biological signature of the high entropy state.
This is where the science translates directly into the subjective experience.
How do you mean?
Well, we've all heard the stories about psychedelic trips, people seeing sounds, hearing colors, feeling profound feelings of universal connectedness, and most famously experiencing the complete dissolution of their sense of self.
Right.
The entropic brain theory argues that none of this is just mystical magic. It is all downstream of simply turning the entropy dial up.
It is. Think about the phenomenon of synesthesia, seeing music or tasting colors. In a low entropy brain, the visual cortex and the auditory cortex are segregated. But when the system approaches criticality and those boundaries dissolve, auditory signals bleed into visual processing areas.
So the hallucination is just the unfiltered crosstalk of a hyperconnected, high-entropy brain.
Exactly.
That is so cool. And what about ego dissolution? Because in almost every spiritual tradition, losing your sense of self is treated as this deeply mystical, ineffable event that takes decades of meditation to achieve. But in Carhart-Harris's framework, it's a mechanical reality.
It is entirely mechanical here.
Yeah.
Because the self, that feeling of being a distinct you inside your head, isn't a physical object.
Right. There's no gland of the ego.
No. The self is a high-order, highly organized pattern imposed on your brain activity, largely maintained by that default mode network we talked about.
It is the ultimate low-entropy constraint.
Yes. It is a tightly woven net holding your subjective reality together.
So as the psychedelic raises the brain's entropy, moving the whole system closer to that chaotic critical edge, that highly organized pattern of the self simply cannot hold its rigid shape.
It can't survive the heat. It softens, it frays, and eventually it dissolves entirely into the background noise of the brain.
Wow.
The boundary between you and the outside world is a low entropy construct. When entropy rises, that boundary vanishes. People report feeling at one with the universe because, from a neurological perspective, their brain is literally no longer differentiating its internal models from external reality.
The system has reached criticality.
It has.
That completely reframes the conversation. It pulls the psychedelic experience out of the realm of the purely mystical and grounds it firmly in the mechanics of complex systems.
It gives us a physical vocabulary for it.
It does. But understanding how psychedelics loosen the mind in this way reveals a startling and honestly counterintuitive truth about what happens when the mind gets too tight.
Yes, this is where it gets incredibly profound.
Right. Because this is where the theory moves from being a fascinating explanation of a drug trip to a vital revolutionary tool for clinical psychiatry. It forces us to completely reevaluate mental illness.
This is arguably the most important application of the entropic brain hypothesis. Because if an expansive, connected, adaptable state is a high entropy state, then what does that say about the opposite end of the spectrum?
Well, see, we tend to view mental illness as chaos.
We do.
If someone is in the depths of severe depression or experiencing intense OCD compulsions or battling a fierce substance addiction, their internal feeling is often one of total chaos.
Right. They feel out of control.
The person feels like they're spiraling, trapped in a chaotic storm that can't navigate. But the text points out that conditions like depression and OCD are defined by this framework, not as chemical imbalances in the traditional sense, but as pathologically low entropy, overordered states.
It sounds completely backwards at first, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
How can agonizing suffering be defined as too much order? I mean, if someone is having a severe schizophrenic break, that definitely looks like chaos.
And that's a crucial distinction. The theory differentiates between different pathologies.
Okay, how?
Schizophrenia, particularly acute psychosis, might actually be a state that leans toward the high entropy side. The brain is failing to constrain its internal models, resulting in hallucinations and disorganized thought.
Like the files are permanently on the floor.
Exactly. But depression, OCD, anorexia, addiction, these are characterized by pathological rigidity.
Rigidity. So while the emotional experience feels chaotic to the sufferer, the neurological reality is one of extreme rigidity.
Exactly. Look at the hallmark symptoms. What is depressive rumination?
Just dwelling on negative things.
Right. It is a thought pattern running in the exact same dark groove over and over again. I am worthless. Nothing will ever get better. I am worthless. Nothing will ever get better.
The loop.
It is a loop that is unable to jump the track. What is an OCD compulsion? It is a behavioral loop. Washing hands exactly 7 times, checking the lock exactly 3 times, that cannot be interrupted without immense distress.
Right.
What is addiction? It is a neurological craving that overrides all other possible options and choices.
They're trapped in the filing cabinet and the drawer is jammed shut.
Exactly.
The text uses this incredible language saying these minds are stuck too far below criticality. They're too canalized.
He's analyzed, yeah.
Like they are trapped in a deep, narrow valley they simply cannot climb out of. The brain has locked itself into a hyper-predictable low-entropy state where the only possible outcome is the depressive thought, the compulsion, or the craving.
The core problem for these individuals is not too much chaos. It is too much rigid order.
I just hearing depression described not as a failing or a weakness or even just a lack of serotonin, but as your brain being over-ordered.
Yeah.
It completely flips the script on how we view suffering.
It really changes the paradigm.
It must be so incredibly validating for someone in the depths of it to hear this.
It completely reframes the therapeutic approach, too. Because if the disease is pathological rigidity, the remedy becomes incredibly obvious within this framework.
You need to loosen it up.
Yes. You need a temporary, controlled increase in entropy to shake the system loose. You need to dump the files on the floor.
Which flies in the face of our entire cultural narrative around mental health. We're constantly told that healing is about taking control, managing your symptoms, building stronger habits, and just you know, getting a grip on your life.
But if your disease is caused by an excess of control, an over-rigid neural network, then trying to impose more control will just deepen the groove.
Wow. You're just reinforcing the low entropy trap.
Exactly. Healing in the entropic brain model requires the exact opposite of our cultural instinct. It requires a temporary surrender of control.
That surrender.
It requires letting the system approach chaos so that the pathologically rigid loop can finally be broken.
Surrendering control to break the loop of control. It's poetic, but we need to understand the gears turning underneath it. We know depression is rigid, and we know we need to loosen it with entropy. But how exactly does this rigidity manifest in the mechanics of our moment-to-moment thoughts?
Like, how does it actually work in practice?
Yeah, how does extra entropy physically dismantle a belief like, I am worthless? To answer that, the entropic brain hypothesis matured over time. Robin Carhart-Harris teamed up with one of the most influential neuroscientists in the world, Carl Fisten, and in 2019 they published a refined model called Rebus.
Rebus. Yes. Rebus is an acronym that stands for Relaxed Beliefs Under Psychedelics.
Relaxed Beliefs Under Psychedelics.
It is also sometimes referred to as the anarchic brain model. And you cannot understand Rebus without understanding Carl Fristen's crowning contribution to neuroscience, the idea of the brain as a prediction machine.
I want to spend some real time on this because predictive coding completely shatters how most of us think we experience reality.
It really does.
We intuitively feel like our eyes are video cameras, our ears are microphones, and our brain just passively sits in a dark theater inside our skull watching the live feed from the outside world.
That passive model is entirely wrong.
How so?
Fristen's framework, rooted in what's called the free energy principle, suggests that the brain is fundamentally proactive. It is constantly generating top-down hypotheses or priors about what is happening in the world, and it uses bottom-up sensory data merely to confirm or adjust those predictions.
Okay, let's ground this. If I reach into my pocket and feel a vibration, my brain instantly generates a top-down prior. Mm-hmm. My phone is ringing.
Right.
I pull it out, but the screen is dark. The bottom-up sensory data, the dark screen, sends an error signal to my brain. It says, your prediction was wrong. So my brain updates the prior. It was just a phantom vibration or my jeans rubbing against my leg.
Exactly. You are constantly updating. Optical illusions are another perfect example of this.
Oh, yeah.
Think of the blind spot in your eye. You literally have a physical hole in your retina where the optic nerve attaches.
Right.
But you don't see a black void in your vision because your brain's top-down prediction machine effortlessly fills in the missing visual information based on the surrounding context.
So it's basically just guessing what's there.
You are constantly hallucinating your reality, and your senses are just there to act as a leash, keeping your hallucination tied to the physical world through constant error correction.
That is wild. So these priors aren't just guesses about vibrations in pockets. They are our high-level beliefs. They shape how we interpret absolutely everything.
From the shape of an object in a dark room to your deepest foundational beliefs about your own self-worth.
Okay.
In a healthy brain, these top-down priors are flexible. They are responsive to the bottom-up error signals.
Give me an example.
Well, if you predict the stairs are a certain height and your foot hits the steps sooner than expected, your sensory data overrides your prior prediction, and you adjust your steps so you don't trip. You update.
Makes sense.
But in conditions like depression or addiction, this machinery breaks down. The top-down priors become pathologically overweighted.
Overweighted?
Yes. They become excessively heavy, incredibly precise, and completely inflexible.
So in severe depression, a prior could be a core unshakable belief, like, I am unlovable, or every time I try, I fail.
Exactly.
And in severe anxiety, the prior is, the world is inherently dangerous. In addiction, the prior is, I cannot survive the next hour without this substance.
Yes. And because these priors are pathologically overweighted, they act like a massive gravitational pull on reality.
What happens when they get contradictory evidence?
Well, no matter what bottom-up sensory evidence comes in, no matter how many friends surround the depressed person to tell them they are loved, no matter how much objective evidence there is of their professional success, the top-down prior is so rigid and so heavy that it simply crushes the contradictory sensory evidence.
Wow.
The error signal is just ignored. The brain essentially rejects the positive input because it doesn't match the rigid prediction of, I am worthless.
It's like you are wearing heavily, darkly tinted sunglasses.
That's a perfect analogy.
Those sunglasses are your overweighted top-down priors. No matter how brightly the sun is shining outside, no matter how positive the bottom-up sensory evidence of the world is, yeah. you are only ever going to see a dark, gloomy, threatening world.
Because the evidence of the sun simply cannot penetrate the tint of the glasses.
Exactly. And what Rebus suggests is that psychedelics essentially force you to take the sunglasses off.
Mechanically, this is exactly what happens. We talked about how psychedelics excite layer 5 pyramidal neurons and increase entropy.
Right.
Well, in the predictive coding model, those specific deep layer neurons are heavily involved in encoding and maintaining those top-down priors.
Right.
By blasting them with entropy, the psychedelic physically decreases the precision or the weight of these top-down beliefs. It relaxes the grip of the deeply held priors, relaxed beliefs under psychedelics.
Rebus.
And when that top-down suppression is lifted, when the heavy lid is taken off, suddenly the bottom-up information can finally flow upward unhindered.
It floods the system.
All the stuff that was blocked out. Buried feelings, repressed traumatic memories, fresh perspectives, the awe of sensory beauty. All the error signals that the depressed brain had been suppressing suddenly rush in. For a window of a few hours, the mind's most rigid, dogmatic assumptions about the self and the world become fully revisable.
This is the absolute neuroscientific heart of the therapeutic process. When you hear anecdotes about a single psychedelic experience changing a person's life, from the outside, it sounds like a massive exaggeration.
It sounds too good to be true.
Right, because we are conditioned to think healing takes years.
Right.
But if you understand the Rebus model, it makes perfect mechanical sense. It offers this rare neurobiological window where the foundational code of a person's identity is momentarily suspended.
Consider the limitations of traditional talk therapy through this lens.
Okay.
You can spend 5 years in cognitive behavioral therapy trying to logically, verbally argue with an overweighted prior like, I am worthless.
Right.
Now, therapy is incredibly valuable, and it does work, but it is agonizingly slow work because you are fighting directly against the brain's fundamental predictive architecture. You're trying to chip away at a solid block of ice with a toothpick.
But a psychedelic experience temporarily dismantles the architecture itself. Mm. It melts the ice. It suspends the rules of prediction.
Yes.
But the ice doesn't stay melted forever.
It doesn't.
Tearing down rigid beliefs is only half the battle. We established earlier that living permanently in that high entropy, completely unconstrained state isn't sustainable for survival. You can't live on the critical edge.
We'd never survive.
Eventually, the drug metabolizes. Hmm. The dial turns back down. The trip ends. So what happens when the entropy inevitably decreases and the brain returns to its subcritical baseline?
This brings us to one of the most vital parts of the entire framework and arguably the most important part for long-term clinical healing.
Okay, let's hear it.
The researchers offer a visual metaphor for this process that bridges the gap between physics and psychology beautifully. They borrow from the concept of an energy landscape or an attractor landscape.
Okay, I'm picturing a rolling terrain of hills and valleys.
Right. Imagine your mind is a physical landscape. Every thought, every behavior, every state of mind is a ball rolling across this rolling terrain.
Got it.
A deep valley, what physicists call a local minimum or an attractor state, represents a highly ingrained habitual pattern of thought.
Okay.
So in this metaphor, severe depression is a ball trapped at the very bottom of a valley that has been worn so deep and the walls are so incredibly steep that the ball simply doesn't have the kinetic energy to roll up and out of it. It is stuck in a local minimum.
That's the pathological trap of order again, the overweighted prior.
Exactly. Now, taking a psychedelic and drastically raising the brain's entropy is analogous to a process in metallurgy called annealing. In annealing, you heat a metal up until it becomes malleable, allowing its internal structures to rearrange. And then you let it slowly cool down so it settles into a stronger, less brittle configuration.
So heating the metal is like raising the brain's entropy.
Yes. In the landscape metaphor, raising the entropy is like violently shaking a snow globe, throwing everything up into the air.
Okay.
Or, to stick with the terrain, it is like temporarily heating up and flattening the entire landscape. The deep, steep valleys just melt away. The terrain becomes a relatively flat plane.
And the ball is finally freed from that deep groove.
The rigid pattern is gone. The person experiences the boundless freedom of the high entropy state. They can think thoughts they haven't been able to think in a decade.
Wow.
But crucially, as the drug wears off, the landscape cools down. The entropy goes back down and the hills and valleys begin to reform.
The snow in the snow globe has to settle back down to the bottom. See, this completely destroys the cultural idea of psychedelics as a magic pill. The drug does not cure you. The shaking just creates the opportunity. The flattening of the landscape is just a window. The real healing lives in where the system settles afterward.
This raises an incredibly important point about vulnerability.
Because they're so open.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because the landscape is temporarily flattened, and as it begins to cool and resolidify over the following days and weeks, the individual has a unique, heightened sense of agency. The brain enters a period of profound neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity.
We see spikes in things like BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which acts like Miracle-Gro for new neural connections. This plastic state allows the person to literally carve new, healthier valleys.
There is a trap here, isn't there?
A massive trap.
Yeah.
If the person just goes back to their exact same stressful job, their exact same toxic relationships, their exact same scrolling habits, the ball is going to roll right back into the exact same deep, dark valley it was in before.
Because the triggers are all still there.
The gravity of those old priors is still lurking in the background, waiting for the entropy to drop so they can reassert themselves.
So the drug only supplies the entropy. It supplies the heat. The person, their intention, and critically their therapeutic support system shape what actually crystallizes when the metal cools.
This is why clinical trials for psychedelic-assisted therapy put so much emphasis on set and setting.
Right, your mindset going in and your physical and emotional environment.
These are not just hippie buzzwords from the 1960s. They are the strict parameters that dictate how the cognitive landscape is going to reform.
Which highlights the absolute non-negotiable importance of integration. We've covered integrations briefly before, but the entropic brain theory makes its biological necessity blindingly clear.
It really does.
The afterglow period isn't just a lingering chemical buzz. It is the critical, fleeting window where you are actively pouring the concrete for your new, healthier valleys. You have to do the psychological work to make sure the snow settles in a better pattern than before.
Otherwise, it's wasted.
Yeah, if you don't do the integration work, you have just experienced a temporary vacation from your depression, not a treatment for it.
You've heated the metal, but you haven't hammered it into a better shape. It just cools back into the same brittle mess.
I love how elegant this overarching theory is. It ties together the pharmacology of the 5-HT2A receptor, the subjective mystical experience of ego dissolution, the Lempel-Ziv mathematical complexity of the MEG scans, and the necessity of psychotherapy into one cohesive story.
It's brilliant.
It is. But as you and I always do on this show, true deep diving requires us to look at where the map frays at the edges. As beautiful as this grand unified theory is, we have to look at its honest limits.
And there are significant limits. Carhart-Harris and the other researchers are very careful to point out that the entropic brain is a framework. It is a hypothesis. It is not a settled, immutable law of physics like gravity.
Right. So let's unpack the critiques. One of the main issues seems to be with the core metric itself, the word entropy and how it's measured across different studies.
This is a massive scientific hurdle. As we discussed, entropy in information theory is a measure of unpredictability.
Right.
But there isn't just one way to measure unpredictability in a biological system.
Oh, there isn't.
No. You have Shannon entropy, Lempel-Ziv complexity, sample entropy, multi-scale entropy. And when you look at different studies utilizing different brain imaging techniques, say fMRI versus EEG, these measures don't always move cleanly or consistently in the same direction.
So one study might show a massive spike in entropy, while another study using a different algorithm might show a much smaller change or even conflicting data in certain brain regions.
Exactly. It muddies the waters. And this leads to a broader, more philosophical critique from the wider scientific community. The theory is highly flexible. Some critics argue it is too flexible.
Well, we always have to be careful with theories that claim to explain everything, right?
Okay.
If a theory is so stretchy that it can be retroactively fit to explain almost any brain scan result, we have to maintain a healthy skepticism. If a theory can explain everything, sometimes it effectively explains nothing because it becomes unfalsifiable. You can't design an experiment to prove it wrong.
That is the exact danger of panacea theories. The precise causal link between a mathematically high entropy brain state and specific therapeutic outcomes is still being mapped. We know that entropy increases under psychedelics, and we know that therapeutic breakthroughs happen, but drawing the direct, undeniable line of causation between the math and the psychology is incredibly complex.
Furthermore, the theory has to contend with a very stark clinical reality. More entropy is emphatically not always better.
No, it is not.
If criticality is the edge, What happens if you push the dial way past the edge? What happens if you boil the water completely away?
You get complete terrifying disorganization. You get distress, confusion, paranoia, and what is commonly known as a bad trip or a challenging experience.
The chaos overtakes the system.
Pushing too far past criticality doesn't lead to profound insight, rebus, and therapeutic ego dissolution. It leads to fragmentation and terror. The brain loses all ability to cohere.
We see this in clinical literature with phenomena like HPPD, hallucinogen persisting perception disorder, or drug-induced psychosis.
Yes.
The landscape was heated up too much, the priors were completely obliterated, and the system couldn't find its way back to a stable subcritical state.
Which again reinforces why dosing, set, and setting matter so immensely. You are playing with the fundamental constraints of consciousness. You want to surf the critical edge.
Right, surf it.
You want to look over the precipice into the high entropy state. But you do not want to dive headfirst into the chaotic ocean beyond it, because you might not be able to swim back.
But despite these flaws, despite the contradictory algorithms and the danger of overflexibility, the supreme value of the entropic brain hypothesis remains. It's unifying power.
It gives everyone a common language. Having a map that makes the whole territory legible is incredibly rare in neuroscience.
It must have been a game changer.
Before this paper was published in 2014, researchers studying creativity on psychedelics, therapists treating treatment-resistant depression, and neuroscientists looking at default mode network suppression were almost speaking different languages. They were working in silos.
And the entropic brain theory gave them a single, testable vocabulary. It unites ego dissolution, network disintegration, cognitive rigidity, predictive coding, and the mechanism of cure under one conceptual umbrella. It is a monumental step forward, even if the edges of the map are still being drawn.
It provides a hypothesis that can be tested, challenged, and refined for the next 50 years.
So let's synthesize this journey we've been on. We started by redefining entropy, taking it out of the realm of thermodynamic decay, and understanding it as a measure of disorder, unpredictability, and ultimately, the richness of our conscious experience.
We learned that on a normal day, our minds exist in a spring-critical state, ordered enough to keep us stable, to keep the tiger at bay, and to maintain our ego, but constrained enough that we miss out on the wild, expansive possibilities of the critical edge.
We saw how psychedelics, operating on those deep layer 5 pyramidal neurons, mechanically turn that entropy dial up. They force the brain's segregated networks, particularly the default mode network, to loosen their grip, eventually softening and dissolving that ultimate constraint we call the self.
And by understanding that mechanism, we were able to completely reframe mental illnesses like depression, OCD, and addiction. We no longer see them as chaotic spirals, but as pathologically low entropy, overly rigid traps, deep valleys where the mind is stuck in heavy, repetitive loops.
We explored Frister's predictive coding in the ORBS model, seeing how psychedelics take off those dark tinted sunglasses, relaxing the grip of our heaviest, most self-defeating priors, and allowing bottom-up evidence to finally flow in and rewrite our internal narrative.
And finally, we looked at the vital importance of the afterglow. The humbling realization that the psychedelic merely shakes the snow globe and melts the ice. The true healing, the actual sustained change, is the hard work of therapy and integration carving new, healthier valleys before the system cools and the entropy drops back down.
It is a stunningly cohesive way to look at the human mind. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to turn it back to you. Because understanding the mechanics of psychedelics is fascinating, but this framework applies to all of consciousness, not just the altered states. The entropic brain theory is fundamentally a theory of you.
Which raises an incredibly provocative thought, building directly on what we've discussed today.
Get ready.
We know that our brains naturally act as prediction machines, constantly trying to minimize surprise and minimize error. They naturally carve deep, subcritical valleys to keep us feeling safe, stable, and energetically efficient.
Because it takes a lot less energy to run on autopilot than it does to constantly process new information.
Exactly. So if we look at the entire trajectory of a human life through the lens of the entropic brain theory, could the simple act of aging just be a slow, relentless process of losing our natural entropy? Think about how wonderfully chaotic, unpredictable, and highly entropic a child's mind is. A child's brain is highly plastic. They are constantly surprised by the world. They are constantly forming novel connections because they haven't built those heavy top-down priors yet.
They don't have the filing cabinet built yet. Every file is just on the floor, ready to be connected to anything else.
But as we age, we build stronger and stronger priors to navigate the world more efficiently. We dig deeper and deeper valleys. We get stuck in our ways. We stop being surprised. We become rigid.
We become the ultimate low-entropy filing cabinet.
We do. And if that is true, if aging is essentially a slow, natural slide into low-entropy rigidity, then keeping the Rebus model in mind, how might you deliberately cultivate a little more chaos and unpredictability in your daily non-pharmacological routines?
That's a great question.
How can you purposefully inject some entropy into your life to prevent your brain from becoming a fossil?
How can you shake your own snow globe just a little bit every day to keep your mind from settling permanently into those rigid, low-entropy grooves? I absolutely love that challenge. It doesn't take a psychedelic to introduce entropy.
Not at all.
It could be as simple as changing your commute to work so you have to process a new environment. It could be actively listening to a completely different genre of music that challenges your predictive coding.
Or trying a new hobby you're bad at.
Yeah. It could be talking to a stranger or finally sitting down to learn a complex skill. You are terrible at forcing your brain to generate new error signals and update its priors.
It is about consciously choosing the richness of unpredictability over the comfort of a groove.
It's a beautiful practical challenge to leave you with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning your priors, keep finding ways to shake your own snow globe, and above all, keep exploring the edges of your own curiosity.